episode 352 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Andrew Swafford and no one else.
Well, Gigi's sitting right here. Gigi, you want to like have some
and
feedback?
And Gigi Kitten.
Gigi Kitten.
I have some kittens over here too for viewers. Hold on. Here's
Cooper.
Not one, but two kittens.
And introducing for the first time on the podcast, Gigi Kitten and Cooper Kitten and Ollie Kitten.
They're all posing.
Yeah, they all have their thoughts on the movie process. On today's episode, we got movies that we saw this week in part one, and in part two, we will be doing our first of two Patreon picks. This one comes from the kittiest of kittens, who's not a patron anymore.
Good episode to have kittens.
Yeah, there you go. But they're not a patron anymore, so like I'm really excited because we can just like lay into this movie if we want to.
Did and it's the not kittiest like we're gonna lose. Of kittens cancel their subscription as soon as they found out we were doing their movie? Like, okay, I got
no,
my money's worth.
While.
I'm done.
It's been a while, yeah. Oh, by the way, this episode of Cinematary brought to you by PBR. PBR, the working man's beer.
Are you, when you're looking at the screen, by the way, do you see yourself to the left and me to the right?
Let's do
a little clink. You know, clink?
Okay, clink.
Clink.
Clink. This is not good audio.
No. This is all the more reason to subscribe to our Patreon, everyone.
That's true. For the kittiest of kittens, we're going to watch 2019's The Prodigy, which is a movie I had no, no recollection or no, knowledge of prior to them sending it to us. So
have you looked up this movie's box office mojo stats? Did this actually play in multiplexes?
We'll have that by part two. How about that?
Okay. I'll go ahead and start some preliminary research.
Go. You know, head over to cinematary.com, though. We got some good stuff. We're going to have some new writing up. And then we're also going to have the Young Critics. That's going to be coming out beginning of next week. So head over to cinematary.com if you'd like to vote on that, which is always a fun time. So, or just go to the website, check it out, you know. Just go peruse. But let's go ahead and talk about movies that we saw this week. I'm going to kick us off. I saw this a couple weeks ago, but I didn't get a chance to talk about it. And that is 2004's Collateral.
Great movie.
By Michael Mann. I got on a... I can't remember if I watched... Did I watch this before or after I watched Tenet? Watched it before. I think I watched... I've been wanting to watch this for a while because I do like Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is very fun in movies. And I kind of wanted to see... I know that people have like pointed at this as like a good Tom Cruise movie that's like outside what you're used to kind of seeing him in.
Yeah, one of the best.
For those who don't know, it follows a cab driver named Max, who's played by Jamie Foxx, who picks up this man played by Tom Cruise, who offers him about like $600 to just drive him around for the night. But then it becomes quickly clear that Tom Cruise is an assassin. And so for the rest of the night, it's kind of Jamie Foxx versus Tom Cruise as he kind of tries to come to terms with like his role in all this and then realizes that he, it becomes a little bit personal. I'll just say that. It becomes personal at the end. And also Mark Ruffalo's in this movie. I just want to, I'm not even going to address, like, dig into, like, what Mark Ruffalo, like, it's just Mark Ruffalo's in this movie, and it's weird.
I don't even
Mark
remember
Ruffalo
that.
Mark Ruffalo is, like, so. The, but he has such a, like, a, so he's the under, like, the undercover cop who finds the first guy that Tom Cruise murders. Tom Cruise's character, what's his character? Vincent, that Vincent murders.
Vincent, yeah.
But yeah, and so Mark Ruffalo shows up and he looks like a white person dressed up as a Latino person. And
is that a thing? Like, is that what they're trying to do?
Yeah, he's like an undercover.
Oh,
he's an undercover cop who's like hanging out with this guy. And so then, but then he like never goes, hey, I'm going to stop and change. He's just like, I'll wear this the rest of the movie.
But is that his undercover persona? Or is Mark Ruffalo actually playing Latino in this movie?
It's just, I was more like, well, why is Mark Ruffalo here? It was kind of like you invited him to a party and you're just like...
Also, Jada Pinkett Smith is in there.
I've been watching a lot of Jada Pinkett Smith movies. Like, I watched Bamboozled. I watched something else with her where I was just like, Jada's good.
She's good. She's good in Girls Trip. She's good in Magic Mike XXL.
What was the other? What's the other Jada? I'm just gonna like look as we record. I've been watching Jada Pinkett Smith movies lately, and Jada's a great actress. I don't think people talk about her. Anyway, so this one's interesting because it's kind of the way I described it when I was talking to Michael a couple weeks ago, because we're gonna talk about it. I think last week. But I was talking to him about it and was like, it's pretty much they take Michael Mann is like, all right, let's have Tom Cruise play his character from Mission Impossible. But this is what it would be like if he was that person, but in real life, because if he was actually that person, he'd be a sociopath and a terrible person. Like, he wouldn't be like a fun action hero. And so Collateral is just like, he's a fun, he's an action hero still. Like, he's pretty much Ethan Hunt, but he's also a sociopath because he's just like, there's there's
no compunction about just killing people.
No, and he taps into like how Tom Cruise has no personality. He just kind of has like this caked on personality that like the thing I love about Tom Cruise is that he looks like he just watched humans and was like, this is how a human is, and like that's how he acts. But he didn't act like a real human. He just acts like what he thinks a human should act like, and I love that about it. It's just,
I mean, I guess that's what people have speculated about him since the whole like Scientology outburst thing, that he's just like totally detached from reality.
But yeah, but that's what makes like I would say this is in the same realm as like Eyes Wide Shut, and that's why he's great in Eyes Wide Shut, is because
that's why he's great.
He's like he's a person pretending to be a human. But yeah, and so it's fantastic just for that, because, you know, you have like all of these set pieces that are set up like you would find in like a Mission Impossible movie or Top Gun or something like that, where it's like, it's very kinetic, it's very like physical, but you like kind of have to grapple with that. He's not the good guy in this. And like, it's kind of like that, it's that movie star playing against type thing, you know.
He also doesn't look like he looks in most movies. Like, usually he just shows up as Tom Cruise.
Yeah, he's like the weird
playing
white
a variation
hair
on himself. And yeah, he has the kind of like Anderson Cooper hair and like a beard.
If it was Anderson Cooper.
Anderson Cooper in Michael Mann's Collateral. Yeah.
But no, he's great. I don't know, like, there's something really effective about that. You know, I think you mentioned before we started recording Training Day, and Denzel's very, like, what's so great about Denzel in that movie is that he's Denzel, he's playing a Denzel character that, like, you enjoy Denzel in, but he's a bad guy. he's not a good person. And, like, it's always fun to see, especially movie stars of the caliber of, like, Tom Cruise or Denzel, who are, like, it's the same thing. I mean, it's the same thing that people had when Leonardo DiCaprio played Calvin Candy in Django Unchained. Like, when you have like this uber movie star, like not really like a, you know, we don't really have like, I think we've talked about it, like, we don't really have like a movie star like up to that point anymore. So, you know, like if people get excited when like Chris Hemsworth's funny in something, but that, you know, it's, I don't know, like they don't have like that distinct persona that you expect when you watch a movie, that when they play against type, it's super effective, that Tom Cruise has in Collateral or Denzel has in like Training Day. And I think that's one of the things that is so effective about the like star persona in movies, is that whenever you have a star who will like take the opportunity to do something like this, it's insanely effective, because there is something too, like, you know, you like the movies where they play too tight because you are comfortable with them, you're familiar with them, and you like to see that. But then it's also just always really entertaining to watch them play against type, because they have like that, it's like that other gear that the movie's working with, where it's just messing with how you watch movies to a degree. And so Collateral does a lot of that.
I will say that despite the fact that I remember almost nothing about the plot of this movie, other than it's Tom Cruise holding Jamie Foxx hostage in a taxi.
That's the movie.
And the Tom Cruise is like evil. I remember nothing about it plot wise, but I remember the vibe. Like, it's a really strong
vibe. It's a vibe movie.
Michael Mann this is one of the things he does really well. Going back to his very first movie, Thief, which has that Tangerine Dream score that's just like really hypnotic, which is oddly reminiscent of a movie that I'm going to talk about in a minute. But like, I know that he's one of the he's kind of renowned on film Twitter for being one of the great users of digital cinematography. Movies like Miami Vice and Black Cat leaning really hard into, you know, what kinds of new images can we create with digital cinematography. And Collateral was one of his first experiments in that. And I think he's still kind of trying to ape the, I don't know, the classical look of celluloid film, but he's doing it in this with these cameras that are like really crisp and like they capture these like really vivid colors, and just like the nocturnal like urban landscape of this movie as it kind of flies by from the window of the taxi is like just really undeniable.
Well, I'm gonna, you know, screw it up, but it has like that is it Chris Cornell? It has like the...
Oh, yeah, yeah. It has a Soundgarden song.
Yeah. And it's so weird. And I'm like, why is this in here? But it's amazing.
Yeah, he's good at that. Like, there's the Jay-Z Linkin Park mashup that opened the director's cut of... Or the theatrical cut of Miami Vice. You know, these, like, needle drops that feel like they don't belong in any movie. But they work in his specific register of movie.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, this is very much like a vibes movie where a lot of the entertainment just comes from, like watching, like you said, like them driving in the car, the lights of like Los Angeles kind of passing by, just like the like subtle looks that like Jamie Foxx and Tom Cruise give. Well, and you also, I forgot to mention this, you open the movie with this prolonged, super romantic flirtation sequence between Jamie Foxx and Jada Pinkett Smith's character.
Oh, yeah.
That is like straight up a incredibly effective little rom-com that like takes place.
Is that over the phone? Is he talking to her on the phone?
No, she's in the cab with him.
Oh, she's in the cab. Okay.
Yeah, and it's like 15, maybe, I think I would say 15 minutes, 20 minutes tops. But it's like her getting in the cab and them just, and the whole thing is that she says, hey, go this route to my hotel. And he's like, oh, no, this is the faster route. I'll take this. And they like make a bet. And it's just like this super cute, like give and take back and forth between the two of them, before even like Tom Cruise even shows up. That's also like, you're just like, what movie is this? Like, it's like you think you're about to have like a Jamie Foxx, Jada Pinkett Smith rom-com for a while.
You just reminded me of another movie that I'm not sure if people can watch or not. But Zach, did you ever get around to watching ETA, the movie that I scored for our friend Deja, or my friend Deja?
I think I've heard the music.
It's not on YouTube. It might be on Vimeo. Anyways, like 2 years ago, I think, I scored a short film for my friend Deja called ETA. And it's like, it's a shot and set in Nashville. And it's about like Uber, like the, it's a horror movie about like what could happen, what could go wrong in an Uber, you know, when you're Ubering home from a party. And like, you're reminding me of it in that, like, there's, it has the same plot beat played very differently, where she gets in the Uber and says, hey, go this way, and he goes, no, I'm going to take you this way, and it goes horribly wrong. But the reason I bring it up here is not just to kind of like pimp my own product that I helped create, but also that it kind of looks like Collateral. Like, her cinematography has a very similar vibe, and I don't think Deja's seen Collateral, but she just kind of like happened upon that look, and it's really nice. So if anyone's interested in watching a really good short film that I helped make music for, you could do some searching for it.
But it does not have any Soundgarden needle drops.
No Soundgarden. So. No, I'm not on that level.
You got to get up on that level. Well, Collateral is on Amazon Prime now, so if you have not seen it, there you go. Speaking of vibe movies, I feel like this kind of got talked about a lot just for... and gesturing, like everything around this actual movie. And then the movie came out. And after watching it, I'm going to be honest with Chris Nolan, nobody would have liked this even if it was in theaters.
Well, it was. It was in theaters.
If it was a normal year of theaters, nobody would have liked this movie. I liked it. So Tenet, the latest Christopher Nolan movie, Tenet, because it's just, so this movie, and honestly, I respect it. I respect it because it's just like Christopher Nolan goes, do you want a plot? Throwing it away. Do you want like cohesiveness? Just throwing it away. All I'm giving you is boys and vibes. And I'm like, hell yeah. And so Tenet, again, in the most basic sense, Tenet is about, you have John David Washington's character who's literally named protagonist.
Wait, no. Okay, so I've heard this as a meme and I need to know to what extent it is true. Like, he has a birth certificate that says protagonist on it.
Well, no, in what movie does somebody go, well, let me see your birth certificate?
Well, no, that's what I'm asking. Like, is it some sort of weird, like, code name thing? Is it a dream logic thing? What's going on there?
See, you're asking too many questions for Tenet. I'll be honest with you. Because the word Tenet, he's literally his only, well, I mean, he has like guns and stuff, but like his armor is, he uses the word Tenet and that like opens doors for him.
He walks up to a door and says Tenet and it opens?
No, not in a physical sense. It's like you walk up to somebody and you work it's hilarious. Like he works Tenet into the like sentence that he says and they're just like, oh, it's you, the protagonist. Yeah. So the whole,
is it like, I'm made of questions right now. Like, is it,
I can't answer them, but okay.
Is it like a simulation theory thing where like he's one of the, everybody else is a non-playable character and he's one of the real people?
Kind of. So like the whole thing with this movie is he's in like the real world, but the future is in communication with the past, or in this case the present, and there it's like sent back in however way it describes. I kind of forgot, but like it sends stuff back from the future to the present. And you also have these machines that let you manipulate time, and they're pretty much like, the person who has all those machines is Kenneth Branagh, who's playing a Russian Bond villain who's insanely misogynist. He's great. Not because he's a misogynist, he's just like, he's super fun because you just fucking hate him the entire time. But he has like these machines that you can go and like John David Washington will like be like, will walk into a room and see like bullet holes. Like, you've seen that poster, have you seen the, or like not the poster, the trailer where like he, there's like the glass and there's like the bullet holes in the glass. And so like you have this whole scene where he like walks into the room and those are already there. And then later in the movie, he like enters the machine from the other way and comes out and it goes through the whole sequence of how those bullets got into the glass and like what happened, because it's like you have the regular world and then you have the time, like the future time world, that is everything but in reverse. And it's literally in reverse, like everything is working, like he has to like drive around and walk around and do all that stuff in reverse. I don't know if that answered your question.
No. Not even a little.
It's not. Let me just tell you.
I now have so many questions that I don't even know how to ask them.
Like, I'll be honest with you. Like, there's no reason. There's no reason to like firmly understand this movie. I don't think any. Like, I don't, because again, like, it's not the point. Like, Christopher Nolan is going, I don't care about the plot. I don't care about like anything cohesively coming together. It's literally just like ideas and set pieces and vibes. And so you have John David Washington, and then it's pretty much a Bond movie. Like, so John David Washington is James Bond. You have Robert Pattinson as, like, I guess James Bond's friend. I don't know really what his role would be in the equivalent of James Bond.
I wonder if at one point this was an Idris Elba movie, when everybody was trying to get Idris Elba to play Bond, and the Bond people were like, no.
Maybe.
And maybe Christopher Nolan was like, I'll make your Bond movie, Idris Elba.
I'm trying to think of who I would like more. Maybe Idris Elba. John David Washington's fine. He's just not very... he's not very charismatic. His dad's so charismatic, and he's just kind of bland. But it also might just be his roles. I don't know. Robert Pattinson's super good in this movie, though. Robert Pattinson's super fun. He's just like... because, like, the whole thing is they're just buddies. And they're just doing their time heists. But, like, the thing that makes this perfect for Christopher Nolan is he literally just, like, builds into this 2.5-hour runtime, like, his most insane set pieces that he's ever put on. Like, get Dunkirk out of here. Get The Dark Knight Rises out of here. Get Inception out of here. That's, like, child's play. Like, he goes hog wild on this movie on, like, set pieces. They talked about it before the movie came out, but he literally runs a plane into an air hangar. For why, you ask? I don't know. It was super cool, though. It just blew up. He also has, like, a scene where John David Washington and Robert Pattinson, like, bungee jump off of a building and into, like, a market, and they, like, get rid of the bungee cords and just walk. It's great. It's way too long. It's 2.5 hours. It's way too long. Yeah, that's it. Like, I'll probably end up watching this again at some point, but not anytime soon, because you kind of have to commit to it. Because
his movies are too long when they make sense.
Exactly.
And I can't imagine watching a 2.5-hour long movie that doesn't make sense.
Well,
one from Christopher Nolan, anyways.
Well, yeah, but so what you kind of have to do is you just have to, like, ride it. Like, it's just like you kind of have to just ride, and, like, again, you can't be like you are and, like, asking questions. No questions asking. Just, like, go, okay, this is what we're doing, and just go with it. Because like I said, at its core, it's like a Bond movie. You have James Bond, who's John David Washington, and you have Kenneth Branagh's character, who's a mean rich person who wants to like blow up the world, and he has to stop Kenneth Branagh from blowing up the world. If that helps anybody, that's what the plot of the movie is. But then there's a lot of other stuff happening around that. So I enjoyed it. It's like a little bit James Bond, it's a little bit Michael Mann. It's very much just, you know, let's... And, you know, honestly, compared to, like, Inception, this movie is pretty good at, like... because instead of Inception, where he's like, I'm going to spend an hour explaining everything to you, he learned the lesson.
It just doesn't.
He just goes, I don't give a shit if you understand this or not. We're just going to go. And, like, I love the script in this, because there's lines in it that I think, like, I'll just be judgy. A normal Christopher Nolan, like, fan person would come in and be like, this is nonsense. But it's supposed to be nonsense. Like, none of these people are supposed to be conversing in a way. It's kind of like what we were talking about with Tom Cruise. None of these people are supposed to be conversing in a way that's, like, actual conversation that, like, an actual person would be speaking. It's all just in this, like, weird, like, what are you talking about speech pattern that I find that honestly, most of this movie is unintentionally hilarious, because you're just like, what are you talking? Like, I mean, you have the whole, we live in a twilight world that everybody keeps saying to one another. And you're like, what are you talking about? But it's great.
Wait, that literal line is said, we live in a twilight world?
Oh, they say that constantly. They're just...
oh, okay.
That's like the whole, we live in a twilight world. And they're like, oh, it's that guy.
I've heard this movie discussed so much that I figure that, like, there's not even any point in me watching it anymore. But the more you talk about it, the more I'm like, oh, that's a thing in this movie.
It's a fun experience. Like, again, like, it's a fun experience because it doesn't make any damn sense. But it also is, like, fully, like, aware of that. It's like, yeah, no, it's just nonsense, man. Like, just enjoy it. And so you just kind of, like, take in the set pieces. You take in the nonsense. Robert Pattinson's is pretty fun. Like, he seems like he's having a good time. Kenneth Branagh's having way too good of a time. and yeah, it's a good one. It's on HBO and HBO Max right now. So There you go. Tenet.
Okay.
It's nonsense.
Yeah, you don't even have to put, you know, people at risk to watch it anymore.
Now, it would have been it would have been amazing to do like the whole Christopher Nolan treatment where you go to like an IMAX theater and see this, because again, the set pieces are insane.
Was it shot in IMAX?
No, he didn't shoot it like he's been shooting the other ones. But it's still like this is a good movie theater movie. I still contend that nobody would have liked it, but it would have been more entertaining at a movie theater.
Oh no, he didn't shoot it in IMAX. He shot it on film, right? He's been doing that lately.
Well, there you go. I can't even imagine, like, all right, we're going to shoot it on film. You got to say we're in a Twilight world, like, 80 times. With a straight face. You can't laugh at it. All right, well, Andrew, I'm going to toss it over to you.
Yeah. Speaking of vibes, I have a good vibe movie for everyone. It's more of a bad vibe than a good vibe, but it is a strong vibe. And that
this
is the movie.
This episode of Cinematary brought to you by Vibes.
Brought to you by Vibes, man.
And PBR.
This movie is Prince of Darkness by one John Carpenter. This came out in 1987. My frame of reference for this movie is I've heard it talked about as the final movie chronologically in what some people call John Carpenter's Lovecraft trilogy, with The Thing and In the Mouth of Madness, and then this movie. And of the three movies, this is the one that's the most abstract. It is... With The Thing, you know, all these movies are kind of dealing with unknown, like unknown antagonistic forces, because that's kind of what Lovecraft is. But I would say that in The Thing and Prince of Darkness, there's much more of a concrete, like the audience kind of has a concrete understanding of like what the actual threat is. You know, in The Thing, there's some sort of alien virus that's constantly mutating. In The Mouth of Madness, there's this cult that's spreading and this madness that's spreading. And in The Mouth of, or in... Sorry, what's the name of the movie I'm talking about? Prince of Darkness.
Prince of Darkness. It's on the banner.
It's on the banner. In Prince of Darkness, it's kind of unclear what the actual, like, dark force that is being unleashed is. I wrote in my Letterboxd review of this movie, I quoted the critic Adam Naiman, who recently went viral accidentally on Twitter, asking people, you know, what are some examples of truly evil movies? He said, not necessarily in terms of depicting it or thematizing it with ideology or politics, but that truly feel like they're channeling something awful into the world. And he said that he was inspired to ask the question by the movie Spurlus, or The Vanishing, which I strongly agree with him is like a movie with a very dark aura around it. Like it'll mess you up a little bit, that movie. But Prince of Darkness, I would say, belongs in that same conversation. I didn't see a lot of people citing it in the replies, but it definitely feels that way to me. The basic plot of the movie is we have these academics who study like quantum physics, and we have these religious scholars and members of the church that are both kind of gathered to the same place, this old decrepit church that looks like it's hundreds of years old, where there's some sort of presence in the basement of the church. And it's not like a presence as in like there's a ghost or God, right? Maybe closer to Satan. But it's actually like this canister. Like there's this glowing green canister that's been in the bottom of this basement. Wait, what was that?
I said it's Ghostbusters.
It's Ghostbusters. There's this glowing green canister.
Also an evil movie.
Well, yeah, that unleashed a different type of evil into the world.
Exactly.
The evil of fanboys. This movie, there's this glowing green canister that has this like weird like liquidy gas stuff inside it. I can't really describe it, but it looks like it's kind of rushing upwards and glowing. And it's like it almost like kind of like a really fast moving lava lamp or something. And apparently this is like a secret of the churches that they've kind of been keeping under wraps for a long time. And for some reason, it's now kind of like becoming uncontrollable. And some of the things that you see happen with this canister are really wild. child, like, and things that are very hard to describe. Like there's this really incredible image where you see liquid flying up into the air. And it's unclear where the liquid's even coming from, but people look up in the air and they see the ceiling is made of this green liquid, which is obviously like they just shot it. They shot a floor and they flipped it. But the way that it works kind of physically in the movie is really disorienting. And there's all this stuff about, you know, the church covering up like the story of Satan being kind of like a fiction, and like there's a real story that people don't want to get out, but now maybe it's time for it to get out. And I feel like I'm doing a poor job explaining what this is, because it is best left unexplained, because the kinds of things that you see are sort of unexplainable. There's like a lot of different disparate phenomena that don't seem to all cohere, but it all kind of feels coherent in a way that you can't quite like wrap your head around. It reminds me a little bit of this great David Lynch quote, where he says, he was asked like where his ideas come from. He said that like he imagines himself in a room and like with a door, and every day under the door somebody like slips him a puzzle piece, but he imagines that the puzzle is already finished in the other room. And like that's kind of the vibe I get watching this movie. Like I'm getting these little clues of what's going on in the other room, but I'm never fully given the full picture. But I get the sense that it does have a complete puzzle over there somewhere. And the main reason I want to recommend this movie is not just for like the very interesting way that it handles like the Lovecraftian narrative of the, you know, this fear of the unknown, but specifically the music in this movie is incredible. I think John Carpenter is really underrated, weirdly, as a composer. I mean, I think a lot of people know he's a composer. You know, Halloween is one of the most iconic horror scores of all time, and he puts out music on vinyl and he tours and stuff like that.
I was gonna say, I feel like people, I don't know.
I mean, I don't
like,
know.
What's
I mean,
wrong with you if you're underrating him?
I don't think that people, you know, when they talk about John Carpenter as a composer, I don't think people are like, yeah, he's not that great. I think what I'm saying is like when people have conversations about the greatest composers, they tend to cite people like Bernard Herrmann and John Williams and people like that. And I don't feel like I ever hear John Carpenter brought up in those conversations.
I guess when you think of composer, you're thinking more in like a classical sense, and he's right. Not necessarily
he's
doing
like
classical music.
He's like a synth rock musician, but his film scores are incredible, and I think this is like hands down his best film score. Like it's better than the Halloween score by like a mile, and the Halloween score is amazing, right? And the reason that I would say that this is better is like the main thing that makes it more powerful as a score is that it is constant. Like the score starts when the movie starts, and the score never stops. Never. Like I think there are a couple of like 10-second periods, like maybe two 10-second periods where there's no music. But with the exception of those periods, it is like one composition that is building and building and building and building for 90 minutes. And it's amazing. And like it kind of goes into different movements and different moods and it is working in different chord progressions and things like that, but it all feels of a piece. And it's like, it is, I would say, the main thing that kind of keeps the audience enraptured throughout this movie. Like there are a lot of stretches of this thing where I didn't quite know what was going on, or where the plot wasn't really moving forward all that much. It was kind of cutting back and forth between various people doing kind of repetitive things in different rooms. But I was still just like really caught up in it, because the score, kind of like the Suspiria score, just kind of pulls you in. And I would also like compare this favorably to Dario Argento's Suspiria. Like it has a similar vibe to it, in that it is driven by vibes, and is able to kind of spin suspense and tension out of essentially nothing. Like, think about that scene in Suspiria where, like, there's a girl who's stuck in a room and she's being chased by something, but you don't know what. And the thing that's chasing her, like, sticks a knife under the door to, like, try to lift the latch. And it, like, keeps cutting back to it, like, trying to lift the latch over and over. And it, like, it kind of doesn't make sense, but somehow you still feel kind of scared and kind of worried. A similar dynamic is happening in Prince of Darkness. It's really, really good. Like, it's just great filmmaking. And I would say it's, like, among the best John Carpenter movies. I can't decide if it's my favorite John Carpenter movie. It's probably, I would say that, like, the three Lovecrafty ones, The Thing, In the Mouth of Madness, and this one, are all kind of like gunning for my number one John Carpenter spot. But it is a really strong contender. So if people have not watched it, they definitely should.
Has John Carpenter ever worked? This is unrelated. Has John Carpenter ever worked with Nicolas Cage?
No, he has not. But that would be wild. That would have been
I don't know if... does John Carpenter direct movies anymore? That would have been fun.
No. I don't know. Every so often I see, like, John Carpenter interview quotes come across my Twitter timeline, and it seems like he's just enjoying royalty checks. Like,
which, honestly, people, we all would be.
I saw one recently where somebody was like, do you ever miss those days when you were, you know, making all these great movies like Halloween and They Live and Escape from New York? Do you miss those, that those glory days of just like making stuff? And he was like, no, making stuff's hard. I would rather stay home and get free money.
Dude, I love John Carpenter because now all he does is like sits at home and plays video games and watches NBA games. Sounds like an amazing life.
What was the video game that people were talking about him being obsessed with? I feel like it was like one of the Sonic games, like one of the bad Sonic games.
Something like that. Yeah. But like I've seen an interview where he's just like, yeah, I like playing video games. I like to watch some NBA games later. And that's like what I want to do. I'm like, hell yeah, that sounds like an awesome life. Good for him.
Yeah, he's living his best life.
Yeah. But anyway, like that would have been cool if Nicolas Cage and John Carpenter made a movie.
Never say never, I suppose. Though I guess I feel like at this stage of Nick Cage's career, he's like way too in on the joke for...
it wouldn't be fun.
Yeah, like I really was excited about his movie that he made with Sion Sono. And reviews out of wherever it came out, TIFF maybe? Made it seem kind of insufferable.
Yeah. No, it seemed, you know... It is what it is. Anyway.
Are we at the end of part one, or should we? Do we have time for one more? What do you think?
At 37.
Yeah, let's end it. Let's end it there.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break, and then we will be back talking about The Prodigy in part two. Stick around.
Hey, Cemetery listeners. Andrew here. At the midpoint of this week's episode, I want to direct you to some of the non-podcasty things we have to offer. First, if you're a fan of what we do, please consider supporting us on Patreon. For $5 a month, you get three things: a shout out at the end of every episode, the opportunity to choose a movie we cover on the show, and our Patreon exclusive podcast, Film Theory and Chill, in which we look at a piece of theory once a month, deconstruct it, and then just chill out, talking about whatever else we have going on. All Patreon support goes solely to paying our writers for their reviews that go up on our website every Monday. Also, at the bottom of cemetery.com, you can sign up for our free newsletter. Every Sunday, we send out an email with the latest podcast episode, Patreon content, and written reviews. This is perfect for those who want to keep tabs on what's happening, but might be too busy to see the posts when they go up. Before I go, one more quick thing. The easiest thing you can do to support us is to give Cemetery a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to the show. This is quick, free, easy, and we will read your review out on the show once we get it. To recap, consider donating to our Patreon, sign up for the free newsletter, and please give us a rating and review. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
I had you. Now I don't know what to do.
episode 352 of Cinematary. In this part, we will be doing our first of 2 weeks of Patreon picks. This one is for The Kittiest of Kittens, and it's 2019's The Prodigy. Directed by Nicholas McCarthy from a script by Jeff Bueller. The film stars Taylor Schilling, Jackson Robert Scott, Peter Mooney, and Colm Feore. Sarah and John Bloom are thrilled when their young son, Miles, starts to show signs of rapid development and extreme intelligence. Their family bliss soon turns into a living nightmare when Miles' behavior becomes increasingly erratic and violent by his 8th birthday. After seeking help from 2 experts, Sarah is horrified to learn that her beloved prodigy may be under the grip of a dark and supernatural force. Shilling on her character in the film, quote, "I think she's fighting for her son, and she feels a tremendous amount of responsibility for her child. And the intensity of the circumstances aren't something that everyone can relate to, but her instinct to be her son's guardian and do whatever it takes to make sure that he's safe, that he blossoms in the world, is really what I think a lot of parents can relate to." In October of 2018, McCarthy revealed that a scene had to be re-edited in the movie after it was found that it made a test audience scream so much that they missed the following dialogue. He added, quote, "4 years ago, I was sent a script for this movie. For the first half, I was thinking, wow, this is a really interesting and creepy and twisted variation on the evil kid subgenre. But then the script just went to this place that I couldn't believe. That's what made me go from, here's a movie I think might be cool, to here's a movie that's gotta be made." The film includes an interview with another family who believed their child had memories of a previous life that was actual footage of a real interview with James Linegar, whose parents believed his nightmares about plane crashes were caused by having had a previous life as a World War II pilot. In 2019, the New York Times said the movie's occasional chills do little to obscure the thin plotting, problematic pacing, and a central mystery that's left aggravatingly vague. In 2019, the LA Times said a tense and gripping, persuasively acted horror thriller that evokes such evil child flicks as The Omen, The Exorcist, The Bad Seed, and The Good Son, while carving its own pulse-pounding, if inherently far-fetched, niche in the process. And in 2019, the Hollywood Reporter said, struggling throughout with issues of structure and pacing, Nicholas McCarthy's horror feature threatens to debase standards for the genre to levels that even undiscriminating thrill-seekers seem likely to reject.
Wow, man, I've never panned a film that hard. That's rough.
I added that one because I was like, that was pretty good. That was a good one. And somewhere probably Peter Travers was like, this
levels
movie's amazing.
Of depravity. Wait, what was the line again?
Oh,
it wasn't depravity.
Nicholas McCarthy's horror feature threatens to debase standards for the genre to levels that even undiscriminating thrill seekers seem likely to reject.
Debasing the standards of the genre. Wow.
The subgenre of evil kids. I like in the one review where they just name every other evil kid movie that's actually good. Like The Omen, The Exorcist. Like, I mean, yeah, like, duh.
Is The Omen actually good? I've never seen The Omen.
It's better than this. The Prodigy 2019. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
It's dumb. Andrew, why did your student make us watch this piece of shit movie?
I mean, I should say at the front end, I don't have confirmation.
Sorry, piece of crap movie.
That it's fine. That this movie was given to us by a student of mine. However, I am like 95% to 99% certain I know the person who recommended this
was
movie to us.
A student who was possessed by a past life.
Yes. Because he's possessed by a deranged film critic from a past life, and he's trying to torment other film critics from beyond
Pauline
the grave.
Kael came from beyond the grave to torture us with this piece of shit movie.
And the reason I think that it is the student is because, A, I know this student has a particular interest in sociopathy. Not to say this student is a sociopath. I do not think they are. However, I know that it's like of academic interest to them, right? Like whenever
that's what
I was...
it always is.
that's what they all say. whenever we would, you know, be talking about like character motivation and stuff, when we're analyzing stories in class, you know, I would ask things like, you know, why did this character do this? And this student would be like, well, because they're a sociopath. And like, that would be,
it's a fair
that
answer.
Would be a thing that they would, a well that they would go back to again and again. And a lot of times it was valid. Sometimes it was not. But I was watching this and I was like, oh yes, a movie that is appealing to someone who is like deeply interested in the idea of sociopaths, right?
Well, have they seen the other movies that like I mentioned? Like, have they seen like The Exorcist?
Those movies are a little different, right? Where it's
well, they're good. Yeah,
these are movies about like the supernatural and you know evil unexplainable demonic forces of kind of like taking hold of children, and this movie is doing something slightly different where it's. You know, it's an adult, it's a calculated adult mind that has found itself inside a kid's body. And so when I was watching this, I actually wasn't thinking about The Omen and The Exorcist. I was thinking about two very specific movies that came out in like the 10 years leading up to this movie, which are We Need to Talk About Kevin and Orphan, which I know you've seen the former. Have you seen Orphan too, Zach?
Yeah, I watched Orphan with you, man.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yes, yes. So, yeah, I definitely felt like this is a movie that the director saw both of those movies, or the screenwriter saw both those movies and thought, I could do that.
Well, the director clearly did not, because he watched this and was like, holy shit, what is this?
And, like, the key difference is filmmaking, right? Like... We Need to Talk About Kevin has this like really kind of poetic, elliptical, hard to pin down like editing and cinematography style where everything is kind of glanced at from this askew angle. And you're like not, you're questioning reality. It's very much like a psychological character study of the person whose perspective you're seeing all this from. And then Orphan is much more of a, you know, a pulpy, you know, a sleazy thriller. But it's shot like in a way that I would compare to like James Wan or something, where it's just like very muscular, like hardworking camera work. Like it's the camera is always placed in these really striking, powerful places, and the camera moves are all like really impactful on the audience too. And just everything is just like so premeditated for like maximum like. I don't know the word I'm looking for here, but just like but keeping like the audience
thrill.
Yeah, thrill.
It's what this movie would like to be, you know, because like it constantly is setting itself like when it sets up a scare or whatever, it like pays it off. This one, the whole movie, it's. You know, you kind of have like that cliche where you're like, oh, this horror movie's terrible because you can kind of just guess what's going to happen. This movie's kind of like that, though. Like,
tells you what's going to happen. Like, I guess I was confused. I was confused for a minute at the beginning whenever it's like, so the prologue of the movie, I guess before the title card drops, is they're cutting back and forth between these two, you know, seemingly unrelated events. A woman who escapes from a house and she doesn't have a hand anymore, and then another woman who's about to give birth to a child.
She has a hand.
It does. The child has a hand. They are wont to do. She also has a hand. And very quickly into the movie, like, I don't know, 15? 20 minutes, it becomes very clear that like, oh, the guy who cut her hand off died and was reincarnated into this child. And then there's like 30 to 45 minutes of them litigating that. And the characters also finding out, oh, this, you know, my child is the reincarnated spirit of this, like, you know, 40-year-old serial killer.
And these dumb parents, like, He takes like what was without a wrench? He hits a child with a wrench. And they don't go, something might be wrong with him.
Yeah. I mean, to their credit, the proposition, the explanation that's provided to them is so outlandish that I think any parent would be like, get out of here. Like, I'm not listening to that. You know, immediately they bring her in here with like this, you know, reincarnation expert who's like, I figured out what's wrong with your son. It's reincarnation. I'd be like, no, they just thank find you. That guy. Goodbye.
Well, it reminded me. Oh, shoot. What is that? What is that? Oh, it reminded me of Return to Oz. It reminded me of Return to Oz.
I've not seen Return to Oz.
In Return to Oz, when they send Dorothy to like the asylum place, like it just reminded me of that. Where it's like, this seems like a stretch. Like this, you could have taken some other steps before you took this step. This seemed like a rush. But no, it telegraphs everything in this movie. Like, so even if you wanted to be scared, like what test audience was so stupid that they like got afraid in a scene?
Can I tell you a moment that scared me in this movie? But it was a moment where my fear was immediately replaced with laughter. Like, I was genuinely scared for a second, and then I was like,
oh, was it when he turned ridiculous. In that guy's face?
Yes. It's when the kid is sitting in a chair facing away from the camera, and he turns around, and he has the face of the old guy.
That part was hilarious.
It was really frightening because I wasn't expecting it, and then it was hilarious. Immediately, it was hilarious.
I don't think I was afraid. Like, it was more like, what the hell? And so then I had to, like, rewind it back.
It just feels wrong.
And I paused it, and I was just like, oh, all right.
Which, you know, there's another movie that does a similar scare much better, which is The Others. Have you seen The Others?
Yes. Zach? It's a very effective scare.
The scare where the little girl is, like, wearing a bridal veil, and underneath the bridal veil is just, like, an old woman's face. It's like, ugh, it's horrifying.
Yeah, this was not that. It was more just like, oh, and then it was like, huh.
Speaking of the face swap scare, I have a qualm with this movie, which is that the movie does not really like play by its own rules, if you know what I mean, right? You know, this is a movie with like this supernatural conceit where somehow, for reasons, because wizards, this old serial killer dude, or actually no, the reason that he's able to reincarnate is because the whole like unfinished business narrative, right? The same reason that people say people come back as ghosts. They died and they had unfinished business. He had unfinished business. He chopped this lady's hand off and he was gonna kill her, but he never got to kill her. So God decided, sure, I'm gonna let you go kill her.
God was sleeping that day. He was like, I didn't what?
Yeah, he's like sorting souls. He's like, that one can go back without really thinking that hard about it. But yeah, like we have this rule that like he comes back and he's in the kid's body. It's a kid's body and it's a serial killer spirit inside. That's all. That's the only thing that's happening. But there are a couple moments where it becomes more supernatural than that for reasons that do not seem consistent with the rules of the movie, like the face swap scare. Why is it that for a second, the mom can see the serial killer's face on the son? He's not a shapeshifter. This is not how this works. There's also there's another scare too that's like, There's a weird supernatural element to it as well. Like he gives her bad dreams or something. Like he's standing over her bed giving her bad dreams.
Yeah. See, I hear you.
Yeah.
I just cared so little about it. Like I hear you and you're right. But yeah. I just cared so little. I was like, whatever. You do what you need to do to get me through this. No, but honestly, like I would have been happier if it just leaned into let's understand the mumbo jumbo, like what it like, let's really just get into this. But it like wants this, like, because it does, it like wants to lay out this, like, if you were a parent who had a, you know, child who was possessed by a serial killer, what would you do? Like, that's the lesson I want you to kind of present you with. I'm like that's stupid. So like I would have just leaned into the mumbo jumbo and just like really went with that, but instead they want to like make it a parable, and it's a terrible parable.
Because like and when you talk about Kevin and An Orphan, like those are both really thematically dense movies about motherhood. And about
this is
like
nothing about motherhood.
Yeah, I mean those movies they legitimately do tap into the idea of like, you know, worrying about what if my kid is awful, you know, what if it comes out wrong. Or what if I mess it up, you know? And this movie doesn't really do that. It's like, what if my kid was possessed by a serial killer? And it's also like, it's not particularly thoughtful about like sociopathy either, I don't feel like, you know? It's just like, you know, some people kill people because they want to kill people. And
this
that's,
guy just sucks.
You know, this is like Chucky level stuff.
He speaks Hungarian, you know? I'm just right. Like, oh, all right. Like, why did Hungary get dragged in this, you know? Like,
what did Hungary do wrong?
Yeah, Jesus. I like that also, like, when he goes to see the psychiatrist guy and he just starts speaking Hungarian, he's like, how do you speak Hungarian? And
I learned it for you.
But when the proper response was, why did you even know that I was speaking, why would you know that? Like, why aren't any of us speaking Hungarian right now?
Oh, also in the psychiatrist scene, the kid leaves a secret message for the psychiatrist by scratching a name into the leather couch while the kid is having a fit of some sort, when like the two spirits are battling in his head. How does a kid with one hand like clearly scratch a name into leather couch with his fingernails?
Well, he has two hands. He's not the lady.
But he does it with one. It's only on one couch cushion.
Oh. I don't know how he scratched a name, and that was pretty bullshit. You know, again, I was just like, whatever. You work with whatever you need to work with. What is it? 70 minutes? All right, I got 20 left. So I want to dig in on the whole thing's stupid, but like the stupidity of the ending of this movie. So let's set up the ending. So by this point, he has crashed his dad into a. First he stabs him with, because there's just tools lying all over the place in this movie.
He always has shears.
Yeah, like,
for some
like,
reason.
Like one, parenting 101, keep the shears away from your child. But he just has those everywhere. He's just like,
also, like, he uses the shears to cut the dog's paw off. Did I miss something? I feel like there was the dog hanging out in the hallway scene, and then next thing you know, they find the dog dead and rotting in the tool room. Is it a shed? Is it a basement? Is it a garage? Unclear. Was there any point where the parents are like, where'd the dog go? I feel like that never happened.
Well, they had the whole scene where he's like, where'd the dog go? And then they drive him around, and then the dad, and that's when he's like, why did your dad beat you? And his dad's just like, what the hell? And then, but also, then you also have the scene with the babysitter where she like walks downstairs, and somebody pointed this out in the Letterboxd review, so I'm stealing it from them. But and no, let's just like, I hate getting into like, well, in a logical world because it's a movie, but also like the light's not working because he unscrews the light bulb. You got a cell phone? Like, you're not going in there in the pitch black. What are you talking about? You would
also
see the glass.
To make another comparison, and this is not even a movie I like, but did this movie come out after A Quiet Place? I think it came out after A Quiet Place, which does the same slowly walking down the stairs and stepping on a
it
sharp
did.
Object.
It came out a year
trick.
After.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just a blatant ripoff right there.
And you're ripping off John Krasinski, who rips off everybody. God.
Yeah, I mean, when you rip off Lynn Ramsey, I have a
yeah,
little respect
but
for you.
John,
but don't rip off
John
Krasinski.
God. Anyway, so the end of this movie, so the dad is like incapacitated, but he was pretty boring and pretty milquetoast anyway, so whatever.
He was my favorite character. He seemed like a good
he
dad.
He did, yeah. I mean, he was milquetoast. That make him a bad person.
Yeah.
So the mom, her plan is that, all right, so what I'm going to do is so she learns that the serial killer is inside her son. So what she does is she goes with him, for whatever reason, to a pawn shop.
Why does she take him with her?
To the pawn shop. Anyway, again, I don't know. They're bad parents. What are you going to do? And then she gives him sleeping pills to drive him out to, like, because of course this lady like lives within sleeping pill driving distance from them, unless he just took sleeping pills a lot. I don't know. And so her plan is, I'm gonna go
and like, also does the mom communicate ahead of time that she's coming to see this woman?
No,
because
she does
when
not.
They get there,
that woman is confused. As she should be.
Yeah, but like they're talking on weirdly familiar terms, like this woman knows what
you know, the main character's problem is.
Well, it's weird. Well, she kind of is like, oh, it's another person who's like obsessed with my story, because like, I guess she had like been,
that makes sense.
It had been documented that she what she went through. So she, but still, you shouldn't invite this person in. She's a stranger.
No, no,
you know, whatever.
This poor woman, by the way, she says, like, I have a rule about not letting people into my house. And this woman's like, please, just this once, I need, I'm unsafe and I need sanctuary or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, immediately, like the first person you let in your house after breaking your own rule, like pulls a gun on you.
So the thought process of this mom is, I'm going to kill this woman so that then the spirit will feel like cleansed or what, you know, like the,
his unfinished business will be finished.
He'll be all finished and he'll leave and I can have my son. But first, the hell is wrong with you? You're just going to kill this woman. But then she like gets second thoughts because the woman goes, oh yeah, like I have a husband and a son, but I don't like, you know, I didn't want to drag them into this crap. And so I don't really talk about them. And she's like, oh shit. Like I can't kill this woman. She has a husband and a son. But I was like,
who cares about her?
You shouldn't have killed her. You shouldn't be trying to kill her beforehand. So then naturally, you know, I'm going to spoil it because you shouldn't watch this. But so then the kid naturally wakes up from like the longest sleeping pill of all time. And
or maybe never took the sleeping pill at all.
That too. I mean, the mom was way too trusting in that situation. And he just slices her, slices the woman up and she's dead. And then honestly, a little bit comedic. The mom then chases the child out into the field, and a very natural reaction when she's pointing a gun at him and is about to kill him. Some other person is rightfully went, "What the hell is going on over there?" and shoots her.
It's a Deus Ex Machina thing where she gets killed instead of the kid. And like, I'm also thinking logistically from the mom's perspective. I know I'm trying to like save my son from the supernatural serial killer who reincarnated into his body, as one does, but also like I just became responsible for the death of a famous woman. How am I gonna cover that up, right? No attempt is even mentioned. And then now I'm gonna decide to kill my own son. I mean, I guess the step three is I'm gonna kill myself, right? Because there's no way out of this. But if that's not the thing that she does, like,
it wasn't,
where do you go from here? How do you go back to a normal life after that?
It wasn't a thought out plan. It wasn't a good plan. It was a bad plan. And she kind of, you know. So then, like, it ends, and it's like he's with this, like, kind of foster family or something. But his dad's still there. I mean, his dad's still alive. He's not going to be
in the hospital.
Not going to be thrilled. He's not going to be thrilled when he gets out, if he does. But
I would also say, to back up just a little bit, you skipped over what would be a perfectly fine ending, and then they give you another shot that would be a perfectly fine ending, and then they give you a third ending, which sucks. The first perfectly fine ending is, you know, the hunter guy who just so happened to be standing over there kills the mom, and he like goes back into the like I'm a little baby act and runs up to the hunter, and you get the sense like, oh, he's just gonna do it again, right? And then you get another scene that's communicating the exact same thing. They take him to a foster home, and like he sees his new foster mom.
I'm a little baby.
And I'm a little baby. And you get a close up shot on this woman's hands, because you know he has this kink for cutting off women's hands, and it would, and then you get like a diabolical smile from the kid, and the movie could end there. You know, I'm gonna kink shame that one.
if your kink is cutting off hands, I feel like you should be shamed.
Don't do it. Only consensual hand cutting off.
Yeah,
please
make sure you ask him.
And sometimes not even then, you know. But then the movie could end there on the shot of the hand, and it doesn't. It goes to him. He goes into his little bedroom and he looks in the mirror and like, ah, surprise! In the mirror is the serial killer again. Like, of course. I knew that. I've known that for an hour and 25 minutes.
Yeah, they keep showing that guy, and I'm like, we get it. Yeah.
Why did I ever need to see him?
Why did I ever need to see him?
If anything, it would have been more interesting to not show him, because then you could have been like, oh, like, is he even actually possessed, you know?
Have you seen Birth by Jonathan Glazer?
I love that we just name better examples than this movie.
This is just a movie. This podcast is a recommendation. It's a list of recommendations.
Kittiest of Kittens, I hope you're listening to this, because we're just offering you up stuff.
Please be taking notes. Yeah, so in Birth by Jonathan Glazer, Nicole Kidman plays a woman whose husband has died and she's grieving him. And this little boy comes and finds her and says, like, hey, by the way, I'm your dead husband reincarnated. I want to be with you. And she's like, that's weird. And you're a boy and I don't believe you. And the whole movie is like is he actually the husband? And it's still kind of ambiguous at the end. This movie would be way more effective if maybe there was an element of that.
This is also the plot line. I would not recommend this one. This is also the plot line of Wonder Woman 1984.
Oh, God.
Where Chris Pine's character comes back to life and embodies some poor man's body. And then Gal Gadot, shout out to the IDF,
actually, no shout out to the IDF.
But she
just to make that crystal clear,
she has sex with that guy, which is weird. And then it's a whole thing.
Yes, correct.
So
at least it's not a little boy. At least she doesn't have sex with a 8-year old.
No, it's just a stranger whose
life is just yeeted away from him.
Just used.
Yeah.
Speaking of the whole situation, that there's a scene in Wonder Woman 1984. I'm not going to get into that. Never mind. We're not going to go into that situation.
We're not going to get into Israeli-Palestinian politics?
No.
Okay.
Free Palestine, you know?
Yeah, I hope our stance is obvious from just our general politics on the stream or on the podcast.
I'm just gonna leave this, you know. We're just going to leave that on. We'll be good.
There you go.
Prodigy, no good. I'm going to be honest. Like, just... if you spend the whole chat naming other movies, it should tell you what the this movie. And it's just, again, like it's not a bad, it's not a dumb premise. I mean, you can make an Evil Kid movie again. Like, it's not like you can stop making those. But again, like you said, like, it's just not right. It's not good.
And I don't want to. I worry that my student, who probably recommended this movie, is going to listen to this and think that we're bashing him.
No,
he has bad taste. And that's not the thing. Like, this is, you know, when I was the age of this student, I got really obsessed with the Jim Carrey movie, The Number 23. Do you remember this movie where Jim Carrey creates, you know, it's this weird, like, phobia fixation on the number 23. He starts seeing it everywhere. And it's, like, not a very good movie, but it's, like, has just enough, like, psychological intrigue in it to make somebody who's not seen a whole lot of movies watch it and think, like, wow, that's deep, you know? And I would say that, you know, loving this movie is really just kind of an indication that you're probably ready for some of these the better versions of this movie, right? Like, go watch The Omen, go watch The Exorcist, go watch When You Talk About Kevin, go watch Orphan, go watch Birth.
Rosemary's Baby.
Rosemary's Baby. You know, like, I can imagine, the only way I can imagine watching this and really liking it is if I had not seen the other things that's doing this thing better.
Yes, Ron, I would agree with that.
Isn't The Exorcist the mother of all mother of possessed child movies? I'm trying to think if there's anything older.
What is mother of all mother? That's a little redundant.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe Village of the Damned is also a possessed child movie, but it's not just one possessed child, it's lots of possessed children. Also really good.
The Exorcist. Like, it's
great.
That one legitimately frightened me. Like, that one's a that's a freaky ass movie.
Especially if you watch, I mean, this is, I guess, somewhat controversial, but if you watch the version that has the little, like, subliminal inserts, I love that stuff. I think that's great.
Yeah. No. Again, like, Kitties the Kittens, this isn't like an indictment on you. It's fine. You know, I mean, if you want to feel better, like, go back, what, 2 episodes ago to episode 350, where we were talking specifically about movies that we watched when we were younger that we kind of like that were not good.
Yeah.
So it's,
that was younger than this person, but yeah.
Still.
I mean, we all fall short of the glory of God, you know? We have all been cringe.
Yeah, no, it's not a big deal. But take this and then go and watch The Exorcist and all these other movies that we've mentioned over the course of this entire 30 minutes, because we've named so many movies.
And I want to draw a very stark contrast between the student who recommended this movie and the students who made us watch Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, I don't like them.
Because those people were just... They were, you know, mean and dumb and had bad taste and refused to change.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't like
they're
them.
they're just living a meme, and you know, art doesn't matter to those people. You know, this if you like this movie, and you think it is like really has something to say, art probably matters to you on some level, and so go check out some really good art, because there's a lot of really good art out there that's along the same lines.
Yeah, do that. Screw those Romeo and Juliet kids.
Yeah.
I don't know. We can't really talk. We talked about October like 2 weeks ago. So, you know.
Oh, that's still happening.
We're living in a meme as well.
We're going to investigate the meme. Interrogate the meme.
Yeah. To the chagrin of other cinematarians. So.
I'm doing a little like midday school club next year. Called Meme Analysis, where I'm going to have students bring in memes they saw this week, and we're going to analyze them.
There you go. That's a, you know, instead of movies we saw this week, we have memes we saw this week.
Memes we saw this week, where I get to find out how many of our students are secret Nazis.
That's true. That's a good gauge. That's a, yeah. Yeah. That's smart.
It really is.
You should, yeah, that's true. Any other thoughts on Prodigy?
No, not really.
Yeah, just skip it.
I mean, I guess my closing thought is like there's like the bones here of an interesting movie, but it doesn't have, like I said, it doesn't have the filmmaking chops, and also doesn't have the ideas undergirding it to like make it interesting to think about on a deep level.
Yeah, it needs to be
and
funner.
And so all it is plot. Like, it's just plot, plot, plot. And most of the plot is just explaining stuff we already know.
Yeah. And so, it doesn't even have any fun. Like, it's just... It's just very, like very, like, serious.
It is.
You're just like, have some fun with it. Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which Orphan has a lot of fun with it.
Orphan's having a lot.
That's a fun movie.
It's having a good time. I heard that they were making a sequel or prequel or something to it. They're making something.
Is Colette Sarah attached?
Because
I would watch that.
I'm not totally sure. Oh, we didn't look at the Box Office Mojo. The people actually see this?
Oh yeah, let's see. It opened. It did not make its money back. The budget was $6 million, and it opened to $5,800,000. Though I guess eventually it got its money back.
What,
but
what was the week that, like, who was, what was the big movie that week it came out?
Ooh,
what did it
good
get wiped
question.
Out by?
This came out February. Oh, that's in Poland. When did it come out in America? Oh, it was Orion Pictures put it out, which is like such a weird company now. They were like a really big deal in the 80s and 90s, and they just disappeared for a long time. And now they weirdly exist again, but they're only like halfway distributing their movies. Like, they put out Anna and the Apocalypse, but they didn't put it out in like any theaters, even though they're like a big deal. So that kind of answers my question. This movie was probably barely released, and was probably found by this person on a streaming service somewhere, because this is the kind of movie that just kind of like fills up the streaming service bargain bin, you know?
Yeah, this felt like, I mean, I watched it on Amazon, but it's also on Hulu, and it feels like a Netflix movie. So
right.
Take that with what you will.
A bad Netflix movie. There's some good ones.
Yeah, but man, the most are bad.
Most are bad.
Most are bad. all right. Well, that will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we post all the movies that, well, not all of them in this episode because we named a bunch of them, but
we named a lot.
The prime movies that we talked about in this episode. And as we mentioned, patreon.com/cinematary. We do these Patreon picks occasionally when we need to kind of fill in some gaps. And so if you have signed up for Cinematary's Patreon and you have not sent me a movie that you want us to talk about, we'll talk about whatever. So, I mean, we just talked about this one. So, I mean, come on.
No guarantees we'll say nice things about it, but we will watch it and we will talk about
it. That's true.
Yeah. Next week, we got a great one. I'm so excited.
Yeah, shout out to Candace on that one. Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Corey Willingham, Harry Eskin, Candace Sisson, Maggie, Ron Hayes, Titus Arthur, Tyler Chandler, and Whitney Rhea Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. Yeah, well, next week we got Candace sent me that she would like us to talk, and we really can't shit talk this one because it's her favorite movie of all time, so it would be bad.
There's no reason to shit talk it. So.
No, I might shit talk Reese Witherspoon, I'll be honest. Well, we're going to talk about Legally Blonde.
Legally Blonde. Hey, can I give, you know, intrepid viewers/listeners a homework assignment? If you want to get more out of Legally Blonde, you should go read the short story A Jury of Her Peers by... Susan Glassbell is the author, commonly taught in high school and college, so maybe you've already read it. I assigned it to my students this past semester, and my honor students had the option to watch several movies, but one of them was Legally Blonde, and I got some really good essays comparing A Jury of Her Peers to Legally Blonde. I feel like Legally Blonde, like, I'm not gonna be on that episode, but I'll go ahead and give my quick take on it here. It presents itself as like a very like silly movie, but it is actually very, very smart. And that's kind of, that goes along with the, you know, the arc of the main character, I guess. It is a very, sharp and quick-witted movie. Also one of the writers of this movie has made several really intelligent, like chick flicky movies along those lines. And I'm kind of like an auteurist stan for them, though I can't remember their name at this moment. Sorry.
my thing on Reese Witherspoon is like the Tom Cruise, but like a female version of Tom Cruise, where I just feel like she's not a real person.
Yeah, she's cultivated an image for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can address that. She's great in that movie. That has nothing to do with it. I'll probably address that in the next episode. Anyway, thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next week.